It is PMP Weekly, episode 103. It is the 2nd of November 2020. And in the PMP Weekly, we always talk about what's happening within the last week related to Microsoft 365 in general, concentrating mainly, well, not mainly, but also on the platform side of the house. My name is Sasa Juvonen. I'm a program manager from the OneDrive SharePoint side, and with me as the co-host is Waldek. Waldek, who are you?
Hi, everybody. My name is Waldek Mostikas. I am cloud developer.
Can you speak any faster than I do? So,
yes, okay. Again. Anyway. Well, anyways, I am cloud developer advocate at Microsoft. And today with us is Daryl Miller from the Graph product team.
Hey, folks.
Welcome, Daryl. Yep.
Thank you very much.
Daryl, now you're in the Graph team. Can you explain what are you actually doing? What is your job?
Yeah. So I'm an API architect on the Microsoft Graph team. We are the developer experience team for Microsoft Graph. So we produce all kinds of developer tooling, a bunch of SDKs, the Graph Explorer tool. We work on the documentation. And we also help teams bring their APIs to Graph. So I sit on the API review board and help teams when they have their API designs, provide them guidance. And we also work with our sister half of the team over in Identity, which also own a bunch of Microsoft Graph capabilities, and they take care of the onboarding of teams onto Graph. So it's kind of a portfolio team. We do a whole bunch of stuff, and we are growing quite enthusiastically at the moment.
Which is really good, because obviously Microsoft Graph is the API for everything in Microsoft 365. Well, not just that, everything in the Microsoft world. Hopefully in the future, right?
Well, so. there's still Azure. There are the Azure APIs for management and data plane, and then there are the Graph APIs. We're slowly whittling down the number of APIs that developers really need to care about across the entire ecosystem.
Yeah, which is obviously great, because having a product and service specific APIs is just stupid. If possible, you can provide a standardized set of APIs. Well, it's stupid is one way of saying
it's inconvenient to say.
It's inconvenient for third-party developers for sure, and to be always to figure out on which SDK, which APIs, how does this work, and what about authentication and all of that. So, I think we're in a heading for sure to the right direction, having a standardized. Basically layer for all of the information which is available. Now, before we actually go too much on what you do right now, can you explain what is your background? When did you join Microsoft, and what did you do before this?
I've been at Microsoft for about 4.5 years now. I actually joined as an evangelist for Azure API Management, which is a management gateway over in the Azure side. And that was right before the developer advocates team that Waldek, you're now working with, Jeff Sanquist's organization. And there was a plan to centralize. So they said to me, Daryl, we don't need evangelists anymore. I'm like, oh, okay. They said, what do you want to do?
I do.
Yeah, that's right. I said, I guess I've done all the evangelizing that is needed. No, we're going to spin up a whole new division of evangelists. So anyway, so I changed and I became a developer on the API management team. I mean, it's not like I'd started, like I didn't suddenly decide to be a developer before Microsoft. I've been a developer for probably 20 years or so now. Most of that time working for my own company. Myself and my wife work for our own software company, building a very specialized piece of software, ERP software for engineer to order companies in the metal fabrication industry.
Oh, wow, that's so very specific.
Super vertically focused. But we built everything, accounting, inventory management. I've written payroll. I've done like end-to-end operations type software. Many years in that area. And a large part of that work was done, you know, I did my time building SOAP APIs and suffering that pain, and then discovered HTTP and POX, plain old XML, and then discovered REST and went down the hypermedia route for a few years. And then I got pulled into the Open API world and have spent quite a number of years working on the Open API specification. And I continue to do that now. And so that's kind of got what's got me involved in the HP API space. I also did a little stint working as a developer advocate for a company called Runscope, who were an API debugging testing tool based out of San Francisco. APIs have been my thing for quite a while, and they continue to be, and hopefully will continue to be.
Cool, because like it sounds very much like perfect place for you to be now, right? Because like there's no bigger API surface at Microsoft than Graph, I believe.
Yeah, it's very close between the APIs in Azure and Graph. So, but yeah, it's great, and we're starting to work much more closely with the Azure team. There was the Microsoft API guidelines that came out a few years ago that was an attempt to be consistent across Microsoft, and we are still working towards following those. And we do work regularly with the Azure SDK team and the other the API review board in Azure. So slowly we're chiseling away at the differences in the APIs across Microsoft to make life easier for developers.
Yeah, which is obviously great for third-party partners and customers who are building then on top of this ecosystem, which is absolutely brilliant. Now, coming back on that one, actually, just out of curiosity, so you didn't ended up being in the Graph team, and Graph, within the past like 5 years, Graph has grown massively, which is great. So we're getting more coverage here and there and there. What's the number one challenge what you are having related on getting people to actually use the APIs or building the APIs? So how does it work? Can you explain how does it work? Do you actually build the APIs, or who builds the APIs?
Yeah, no. So Graph is a giant proxy. It takes those requests in, it validates the token, it identifies where you're going, it does a certain level of validation of the request, and then passes it along to the backend. There are some services where there is a little bit of transformation that happens. Some services we pass right through and the response gets passed right through. Some services get a response back and there's little transformations. Like in the past, some APIs used to use Pascal case. Well, Graph uses Camel case for all of its properties. So some services, still we do little things like that just to provide that consistency across all the API surface areas. So no, Graph doesn't actually provide any services, and that's why sometimes when you ask us questions about why does this Graph API not work this way, we kind of look at you blankly and go, I don't.
Yeah. Ask them.
Let's see if we can find somebody who can answer that question. And they're like, but aren't you the Graph team? Yes, but we don't actually implement those services. So we are that centralized team that provide those things that we can centralize, like deploying and managing of the docs. Again, we don't actually write the docs, but things like SDKs, because we can build and auto-generate those off metadata, we generate those things. So yeah, we are the central gateway team, as you would say, to all of the awesome services that all of the other teams build. And they bring those APIs, as I mentioned, to this API review board, and we say, yeah, this is not quite the way we do it on the Graph. Oh, by the way, there's another team over here that are doing something very, very similar. Or, oh, by the way, you just created another error detail object. We already have one of those things. Please don't create another one. And so we're kind of that catch-all to try and ensure that we don't do the same thing three different times. We fail sometimes, but...
So you're kind of representing also the partner and ecosystem and community towards then the product team and say, no, don't do those crazy things. We have standards and you need to implement stuff in the right way so that the customers and partners can benefit out of it. Good way of defining that?
Yes, it's very much part of that role, because a lot of those APIs initially aren't built intentionally for third party. They're built for first party type stuff. And we'll look at APIs and they'll go, what is that property? Oh, well, that's a schmoogly ID that is used in such a wiggly blah, blah, blah. And we're like, yeah, no, devs are going to have no clue what that is. Or this is this blob of JSON that we haven't schematized at all. And we're like, no.
Or here we have a header that we use ourselves internally. No customer headers.
Yeah. Like, if it's going to be on the graph, it needs to be documented. There should be no magical things that requires weird shenanigans. We want that experience to be as easy as possible. And in the long term, like, building that API to the quality that third-party developers need benefits first-party.
Absolutely.
It frustrates certain people who have deadlines and they want to ship features and they want to get stuff out fast. And they're like, well, but we don't need that. But
yeah. It's yeah, that's right, actually just to elaborate on that one, because that's a really good way of putting that as well. So unfortunately, there are organizations and teams in Microsoft who consider the first party minimum viable product feature much more important than the let's say the quality of the API surface. So as long as there's something from the API which can achieve then the UX, whatever the shiny thing is, they're happy. And then the quality of the API is not good about a focus point, which then causes, let's say, friction points and debates between the teams on you should do this, and then no, we don't have time, and all of that stuff. So it's an interesting political, let's say, discussion for sure in Microsoft.
Yeah. Well, and we have the no breaking change policy, right? We don't allow breaking changes on Graph. Whereas if you're talking with your sister team who's building some product and you want to make a change, you can go over to that team and say, hey, we're going to do this change. Could you just coordinate the rollout, right? Which you know, you can do. Yeah. You can't do that when you have an ecosystem of thousands and thousands of apps deployed in many, many different companies. You can't just go, oh, by the way, could you just roll out a new version because we decided to change
all your
thing
apps
a little bit.
Yeah.
Can't you just inform the community and tell them that there's a new version? Doesn't that work out? So it doesn't work like that for sure. So, but yeah, is what's the kind of a, in your role? Is that one of the difficult things, or what would be the difficult thing from getting people to understand the purpose and let's say the importance of the graph from your perspective?
Yeah, I think that is an important aspect, and it's a reality of the entire API industry. Like, the web is mature. The web browsers are mature. We're understanding, although we evolve that regularly, but using the web and the internet as a substrate, a medium for HTTP APIs is something that is just starting to mature now. And although we've had a number of companies for a few years who really are APIs a product, large companies are only just starting to understand the value of saying, okay, no, this API itself is a product, and we need to build it with the same level of care and UX focus that we work with all of our other products. So when teams are purely focused on shipping things to their own internal parties, it's not immediately apparent. And if you don't talk with third-party consumers on a day-to-day basis, because that isn't part of your day-to-day role, then you don't understand those impacts, the same thing. And that is a big part of what we are trying to do at the moment, is kind of steer the ship and provide internally that guidance so that people do understand the impact. Because ecosystem partners is what has been built on
for
many years.
Yes.
Right?
So I guess, in other words, you're still evangelizing just in internally.
Sure.
Nothing has changed,
sure.
Really.
Well, I mean, every job I've picked to a large extent has been like, I love working with developers, right? And I like helping developers achieve their goals. So, I mean, it doesn't matter who they are.
And what you were just saying, just to be clear on that one, I would say, and I know, Daryl, that you agree on that, it's not that necessarily the Microsoft internal engineers would be evil for doing the accidental API changes. They're just not educated enough on understanding the impact of their changes or impact of their actions every now and then. And then whenever there's a human mistake, and this might happen every now and then they learn from that, and then they remember that, and most likely their whole team will remember that because they will hear about the fact that they caused some havoc within customers and partners. So I think everybody in Microsoft don't want to break intentionally anybody, but hey, things do happen, and I think what the graph is providing is then the consistency and education for sure for the team.
Well, the hasn't figured out what a breaking change for an API is. When we use a programming language, we know it's a breaking change because our compiler throws its arms up and says, you have an error, right? But when it comes to an HTTP API, you know, I reorder two properties in an object. Is that or isn't it a breaking change?
Sure.
It depends on the client and how it consumes it. So it can get really, really hard. We sit there sometimes with certain changes going, is this or is this not a breaking change? And to who would it be? What would you have to do in order for there to be an error because of this change? And there's really, really not an easy answer to that.
And then figuring out the right way of versioning the APIs in general is for sure, that's certainly hard.
So
that you wouldn't actually break the people. Yeah,
exactly. And I guess like so if you think about all these things, it goes a long way from just thinking about features and product. Like there's a whole dimension to designing an API, maintaining it over time, consistent, and so forth and so on, as opposed to just, okay, this is a product that I want to build. These are the features, ship it.
Yeah.
And the other thing you mentioned about versioning, like this is a really interesting conversation. And we keep coming back to this conversation on graph is we have a V1, right?
When will you have a V2?
And this comes back to our conversation about we're a gateway. Right? We aren't one product team. We are 50 product teams. Yeah. And if you introduce a V2, how do you coordinate all of those 50 teams to be ready at once to say, oh, yes, we have some breaking change that we'd like to do, some old legacy that we'd like to get rid of. And okay, so when will you be ready? Well, we'll be ready on this date. And then you talk to another team like, oh, no, we can't make that date, right?
Yeah.
And so like, well, okay, but then, well, so we'll move some things into V2. And when other things are ready, we'll move those into V2. Well, then what does a developer do? Like you have to start using half the stuff that's in V2 and half the stuff that's in V1. And then you've got links and you're using this feature that points to a user. Well, is that a user in V1 or a user in V2? But this other thing that I'm doing also points to a user. Like it just becomes a nightmare. So we worked really a lot on this late last year. And so one of the things that people are going to start seeing in Graph is, and they're going to look at it and go, oh my, that's ugly. But you're going to start seeing properties and potentially path segments that have underscore V2 on the end. And we call it the breaking suffix approach. Now, most of the time when you're evolving an API, right, you can come in and like there's a property, you want to make a change to it. And you're like, oh, well, we want to make it more sophisticated. It's an address. It has one address. Well, we want two addresses. Well, we'll create a new property called addresses. And we'll make it an array, right? Which is no problem because it's a different name. And we now have the ability to deprecate and we can mark things as deprecate and you're going to get deprecation headers and we're going to enable all the SDKs and Graph Explorer to tell you if you're ever using deprecated stuff. Cool. You've got 2 years when we mark something as deprecated and we'll make sure you understand that that thing has gone away and there's a new thing to replace it. The change log is going to get deprecated information, everything. That's fine. But then what happens to that one case where you have a property and you really do need to change it? You want to keep that name for clarity, but you want to change it and actually change its behavior in a breaking way. And so the idea is you add on underscore V2. So first of all, it's a signal that this new thing replaces that old thing. You can continue using that old thing. You've got 2 years and start using that new thing. All you need to do is just use this different property name. And what that allows our ecosystem to do is to start adopting all this new capabilities, effectively would be breaking changes, but not breaking changes anymore because we just changed the name. And then when we get our ducks in a row and we actually manage to move to V2, we have two choices. Either once the 2 years are up, just introduce the old property. We can get rid of the old property name and reintroduce that property name with the old name.
With the 2 year and then, time
and
cycle.
And just deprecate the underscore V2. That's one option. And we can just continue on V1 forever. Or we may find reasons why we really need to move to a V2, in which case we will introduce a V2, and then we'll just tell you, in the V2, we'll just drop that V2 suffix off. and go back and it'll just be a reset. And you can go into your code base and just everywhere where there was a V2, just remove the underscore V2 and literally search and replace. And that would be the process of moving up to V2. So we're allowing consumers of the API to incrementally adopt these new breaking changes over time. And then the move to V2 will be much more mechanical. So it won't be scary. Like, you know, you have this, whenever there's a new major version, what's the first thing we all do is go like, oh, I've got all these breaking changes lined up, right?
Well, and build, yes.
Bigger yeah. and bigger and bigger. And then the poor person who has to upgrade from V1 to V2 is like, oh, I got to make all these changes in areas that I don't really care about because they've piled on all these massive things, right? So the idea is, we're allowing you to phase in breaking changes incrementally over time. So keep your eyes open for those ugly underscore V2s. They're ugly for
a
reason.
That's a good warning. Good warning for sure. So.
And I guess that is even more the reason, like, why would you want to use an SDK as opposed to craft or issue REST requests by yourself? Because an SDK, like when you update an SDK, you will get all these locations in your code where you need to upgrade immediately. Like, it will be just build errors. Whereas a REST call, well, unless you have a test suite that will actually call the API, like, you won't see it until then, right? So an SDK like gives you the head start in whatever upgrade you want to do. Like, hey, these are the five things in your code you have to change because now you went from V1 to 2.
Yeah, we'll start adding in languages that support it, like an obsolete annotation. So you'll start getting warnings. Yeah, hey, by the way, you're using this particular feature that is deprecated. And as I say, you'll get it in responses in the deprecation header.
Yeah. Now coming back on what the SDK discussion, that's actually a super important discussion because I know Daryl is super, super passionate about generating SDKs from the API surface. Can you actually, let's talk about that one as well, because it's super important that people understand why it's auto-generated, which I think, Daryl, you agree that in certain cases, it's not always the most beautiful looking code as such.
Oh, no.
Because it's auto-generated, but then it has benefits, right?
I don't think anybody really likes auto-generated code, right? It really is a necessary evil. It's the fact that the graph surface area is large and literally it updates on a weekly basis. Yeah. And when you combine the V1 or if you look at the beta API, there's literally thousands and thousands of endpoints. And as I say, there's lots more in the pipeline that are coming. And it would require a team 10 times the size to be able to create a hand-generated thing. Yeah. Now, having said that, one of the first things that we did a couple of years ago was recognize that some people don't want to use those auto-generated models. And we explicitly went through all the SDKs, well, not all yet, but we're getting there, the main languages, the C#, the Java, the JavaScript, and broke them into two libraries, a core and a service library. And the core is the part that provides all those kind of cross-cutting concerns, the retry handling, the throttling, the authentication mechanism. And if you just want to use that and you want to build your own models just for the things that you care about, go for it. That is absolutely a valid approach. And if you live in the .NET space, there's a couple of on.NET episodes that are coming out. And one of them I talk about customizing the .NET SDK and how you can get under the covers and just don't need to use the model classes at all. And our goal with regards to the service library is to create it as thin as possible. It is really just a shell of types for the models and request builder. And request builders are just there to help you construct a valid URI and help you construct a valid payload. And really, if you don't want to use it, it's fine. If you want to use it to create something and then completely customize that request with your own variation on that, you want to insert your own middleware controls that do cross-cutting concerns, absolutely, completely valid. There should no be the problem that people come up with SDKs is, they usually take some kind of opinionated stance on how you should be calling the API.
Developers opinionated? What? Never.
And as soon as that opinion doesn't work for one scenario, it's like, oh, wait, I have to start from scratch and build all of my own infrastructure. And then it's like, well, I've built all my own infrastructure to do this one scenario. Why don't I just use all my own infrastructure for everything that I need? And they end up throwing the SDK away. And that's absolutely what we wanted to get away with. You need to be able to peel the onion and use just the parts that you want to use.
Yeah.
Plus, I guess there's another thing to say that many developers nowadays, especially in the cloud, like people don't always know complexity, like how to properly deal with throttling, how to properly deal with all possible exceptions that you might have with service that you do not own, and you don't always know how it exactly works under the hood, right? So an SDK, like you said, the core piece abstracts all of that away and does it the right way and allows you to focus on your app as opposed to plumbing.
Yeah,
that is exactly what it is, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many subtleties, like just like a redirect. Redirects are simple, right? No big deal, right? We can follow redirects. Well, oh yeah, but sometimes libraries will handle that for us automatically. .NET, they handle it for us automatically. But then the basic redirect drops the auth header. Okay, well then I need to, what happens? All of a sudden I'm getting not a valid auth. But then if you're going and downloading a OneDrive file, if you bring the auth header with you,
it breaks.
It breaks. Or if you bring another header with you, it breaks because of cores, right? So there's a whole bunch of little subtleties. And then, you know, you're in JavaScript on Node.js versus using the fetch that's there versus the fetch in the browser. How does the redirect happen in those kind of cases? And yeah, throttling is an even more tricky situation. So, and the idea is that somebody shouldn't need to know all the peculiarities of the HTTP spec. I mean, caching is another one. It's one thing that we haven't got around to yet, providing an out-of-the-box client-side caching piece of infrastructure, but I would love to be able to do that. And it's just not obvious how to make that work transparently, but you can.
Yeah. Cool. Just from a timing perspective, let's do some articles. Let's get back on the discussion so that, because we do have a hard stop half past. And why am I saying half past out loud? Because nobody can really understand what it means when they're watching or listening this. But anyway.
So now when you look, it is a whole past, and then at some point it will be a half past.
Yeah.
And then we will have a stop.
Yes. Okay, cool. Some new articles from last week, some cool stuff for the Microsoft Teams, a monthly summary, a lot of cool stuff happening. The meeting and calling and meeting applications are coming as well, but there's a lot of out-of-the-box capabilities. And this one is actually pretty cool as well, so you can explicitly unmute people if you have your attendees muted by default, which is actually really cool. Helps on our community calls as well if we want to go there. But I think, especially for education services and education setups, I think that's super, super important. Now, scrolling in here down, there's a lot of cool stuff available for the Microsoft Teams. And then obviously, there's a lot of new stuff also in the platform side of the house. There's a few things which I wanted to actually mention and call them out. So Power Automate, there's an awesome integration there, organizational branding, line of business, Teams application catalog, apparently a big thing to get your logo visible there. Well, okay, fine. Not necessarily a huge thing, but this is actually really cool. I think, Darrell, you've been involved in this implementation as well, at least in sort of level, right?
Only tangentially.
Okay.
Yes, I've
basically
heard lots
resource-specific
about it.
Consent is now GA, so you can actually grant permission only to a specific team, which
or
is
channel,
actually really great.
Whatever
or
it
channel
is.
Or whatever it is. Yes, indeed. SharePoint is actually adapting this gradually as well. So there will be then at some point we'll hopefully have the SharePoint site behind of the teams granted in the same level and all of that. So, but again, multiple teams makes life much more difficult. Different priorities and all of that stuff. So things are moving in a different, let's say, pace. App certification, publisher verification. I think this one also a super important thing as well, because it's actually free for partners to get the verification. Right now, at least, it's completely free. So it's a really great way of getting the acknowledged and verified by the Microsoft as well. So really, really cool stuff as well. So that the customers and consumer side of the application will know that, okay, this company like here, the Contoso organizer has been confirmed to be Contoso, because technically you never know unless it has been explicitly confirmed. Right. Now, on SharePoint side of the house, a lot of stuff, obviously a lot of out-of-the-box stuff. SharePoint Syntex is now gonna get more and more visible. I think it's now G8 since Ignite. We'll actually do a getting started on Syntex in the week from now on a SharePoint monthly community call, which is pretty cool. So Sean Squires is gonna drop by. A lot of out-of-the-box capabilities, improvements, Microsoft Lists, all of this stuff. Everything is available to get surfaced properly in Microsoft Teams, which is obviously the direction where everybody is now heading. So getting everything inside of the Teams. Is it Microsoft Lists or not? You can surface that in the Microsoft Teams as well. OneDrive widget for iPhone. That's actually pretty cool as well. So this relatively recent thing, more a consumer side of the house, but on this day, photos. And these are really good, because it's almost like the Facebook on this day or the historical thing, but it's on your photos without the social media burden and without getting access on and sharing things. So it's just photos which you've taken in the phone.
On all events we used to be at in the past.
Yeah, exactly. So that was when in there and there, I wonder what happens. Anyway, a lot of stuff happening on that side as well. Now, there was also a new Microsoft Teams Toolkit version coming out last week. So a version 1.1.1, it was actually 1.1. Yeah, actually, there's apparently a small update on that one as well. I think it was Monday, and then Wednesday, a small update on that. And there's a change log available, which is basically then listing all of the different updates which is happening, so which is really cool. So good that this is moving forward as well. Slightly related, not a competing thing, your Teams. So if you choose to use TypeScript and Node.js as the backend, that's when you use your Teams. And there's basically the Microsoft Teams Toolkit uses then JavaScript, and it has a slightly different way of implementing things. This one was also updated to, in 2.16 version, which is using updated Microsoft Teams manifest and all of that stuff. So really cool stuff as well. CLI, Microsoft 365 CLI had a new version coming as well. A lot of new stuff getting released. Waldeck, do you want to do a quick update on what's happening in here?
Yeah, sure. So we've done two big things, which is one is we had to replace the inner workings of CLI. If all is well, as a user, you will not see anything from it. But over time, so when we would start working on CLI 3 years back, we chose a package to offer us the ability to have commands and help and everything. And over time, we saw that that package wasn't maintained anymore. So we decided, like, okay, so that is too much for us. Let's just do the few things that we need. So we built that ourselves from scratch. But it also means that we need to replace a few things. So we've done it now. And as you can see, like, it isn't a major change. So we didn't break anything intentionally, at least, right?
Yeah.
Other than that, we added few commands and scripts, and would recommend, or we would like you to give it a try and tell us what you think.
Cool. Things are moving on that side as well. Now, that's an interesting, the removal of Warble is an interesting example of the open source community, industry, everybody across the world that's using open source and building their stuff, but then you had a dependency on something which is fully open source, when all of a sudden nobody's updating that, or the whole team is gone, and it's like, well, my whole product
and then
is based
I mean
on this.
You can do a fork, but at some point, like, it's just maybe like, but that means that now you own that thing too, and now you have to learn all of that code with all their intricacies, which might be explained or not, right? So it's just this, like, do you want to take this additional load, or will you say, you know what, we will either move to something else, like we did with Request and Axios, or you'll say, you know what, we're going to build the few things that we need and not take another dependency. So,
And then, Daryl, this is something which you work together with the Azure team. So Microsoft Identity with Microsoft Graph. What is this? Why should they care?
So this is a layer on top of a layer on top of a layer. You have MSAL, which is the library that will make it easy for you to go get tokens for a variety of different OAuth flows, and it has what they call the public client application and the confidential client application. Now, when you move into like the web world and an ASP.NET, it gets a little bit more complicated because what you're doing is you're taking some kind of credentials that came in on the inbound, i.e. like if you're building a web app, somebody signs in with an OAuth2 flow, or if you're doing an API, they're making a call with a token to that particular API. But then what happens if you want to call another API on the background, in behind the scenes? You need to do a token exchange, or you need to get a new token for the back-end API based on the credentials that came in from the front-end. And so that's what Microsoft Identity.web does. Now, if it turns out that you want to call Microsoft Graph on the back-end, you can layer this extra Microsoft.Identity.web.MicrosoftGraph in there. And it just allows you in an ASP.NET web app to just, as you're setting up the security, say, oh, could I use Microsoft Graph, please? And in the first iteration that was out a month or so ago, it allowed you to do delegating access calls, but it didn't allow you to do app-only calls. And it kind of built the Graph client for you. So if you wanted to do any of that customization that I was mentioning before, you wanted to add in your own middleware, you couldn't. So this recent update adds in app-only support, and it adds in an overload that just allows you to pass in a func that takes an auth provider and returns a Graph service client that you've built based on your own requirements. So it's just some extra capabilities into that layer on top of a layer on top of a layer.
Yeah, that's completely natural because it's all about abstraction layers and making it easier to people to consume things. It's just then the only challenge is always to educating people that, hey, now there's even easier way to do things, and then making sure that they can see the guidance of that there's an easier way to do things. So
yep, and I have a recorded on .NET episode that should come out very soon that
never go.
Is all about how to do this.
Excellent. Cool. Now, and there's a release note, and this is basically then walking through the latest release and what's actually happening over there as well. Now, a few community articles from our MVPs. So, Joe Ferreira had a how to create an RSS reader using SharePoint News, a kind of a good list of things and clarification how to make things happen using Power Automate, right?
Automated yes, flow? Correct.
Yeah, Power Automate, and then creating outputs based on that with the video as well. He also had another article. He's been really busy last week. How to save a Microsoft List personal list as a template. So basically, how to save a list as a Microsoft List template. Yes, that's made sense, kind of. So how to make those things happen. So. Tommy Tavila had a update on his absolutely brilliant Chrome SB editor. It's starting to be kind of a pity that it's SB editor because it's not just about SB, but it's something what he's been
M365 editor for M365.
Something, yeah, it could be the way of doing that. But now he included there a Graph SDK in the console, so you can actually easily do then calls directly in that tooling, and that's a Chrome extension which works in the Edge Chrome as well, and you can easily access information, do modifications on live files behind of the scenes and all of that stuff. It's actually a surprisingly flexible tool, and I know that as an example, Valo Intranet, who builds stuff for Microsoft Teams, is using this tool quite a lot to test out things. So. And that's why Elio is over there as well. And Elio is happy. So, good. Patrick Lambert had a deploy SPFX web part using GitHub Actions and the CLI for Microsoft 365. So the CLI for Microsoft 365, there's quite a lot of actually automations related on CI/CD operations, right, Walden?
Yes.
And
correct.
This is basically walking through then how do you do that, how to make that automation work, not doing things manually, but automating deployments. Good. Here we have an entry from RAM, creating user scoped property in SPFX web part. So basically dynamically changing the web part behavior on the user, which is pretty cool as well, and a video format. There's more and more videos which community is doing, which is actually great as well. And walking through that implementation in TypeScript. So pretty cool. And there's a sample available as well. And this one's from our design god, so Stefan Bauer. Stefan has this challenge that whatever he's thinking is so advanced that people can't keep up on his thinking. I always try to explain him that he needs to explain the basics first and then go to the deep dive. But this is really around.
He does. There you go. Yeah,
absolutely. Building SharePoint client UI concrete from scratch and then walking through the different layouting and scaling on that one. So that's really cool as well. And he had another one actually more than a week ago with where he walks through how the background section design should be implemented in SPFX web parts. And this is something which is actually more advanced than our official documentation, which will be then updated based on this. So we already talked about that one with Stefan. So cool. Because it's a much cleaner implementation, what we officially recommended. So
now we need ideally that should be kind of either template or code snippet, right? That devs can just add as opposed to
making it easier. Yeah. Absolutely. So, and this one is from Luis Fries, how to deploy Microsoft Teams app templates in your tenant. So walking through this awesome ready-to-use Microsoft Teams app templates, so which are ready-to-use production-ready solutions, but people can take those into account and install to their tenants. And they're using their Microsoft Graph behind the scenes. And there's a few things which you always need to do, is like setting up the applications in Azure and all of that. And this walks through the different requirements, making it super easy what to set it up in the tenant and then start actually testing things. So really cool. And in our bi-weekly community calls, we're actually covering every single time one Microsoft Teams app template, which is pretty cool as well. So on the one of the bi-weekly calls on Thursdays. Now, one more from Shaya Ferreira. He had three articles from this week, all tagged with a hashtag BMP Weekly. So we want to make sure that we cover them. But how to post a SharePoint news link programmatically. So basically, how to post a SharePoint news article using an API, which isn't officially, however, documented. And this is one of those things where Daryl is
depending when you watch this, it might work, might no longer work. Exactly. It might work differently.
Exactly. So basically, this is a native SharePoint online API, which the quite typically partners are then reverse engineering, and then they can use it, but we do not, since it's not documented, we do not guarantee that not to be broken in the future. And also the right way would be to have all of this in Microsoft Graph, so that the first party, the feature engineers who are responsible of this capability would implement that directly in the Microsoft Graph, and then everybody can take advantage of that. So, well, we're heading to the right direction, one step at a time. Trust me, it's frustrating.
Breathe.
This one is really good from Sarah Haas. What is a project codex and what is a SharePoint syntax? So what's the difference between these two things? So really walking through that one and have a discussion with the other people in the recording 365 on that. So really good clarification what it is. So briefly just explaining SharePoint context, SharePoint syntax is a subset of project codex. So super clear. And then the final video from YouTube is from Aisha Bass, a build in one productivity hub solution using Microsoft Teams, Microsoft Graph Toolkit. So really cool setup and a summary. And I think this isn't super, super long, just double checking, 36 minutes walking through how to make things happen. So really, really cool stuff as well. But that's for the articles this week. Let's come in the back in here and do some close-ups. And Waldeck needs to go in 1 minute.
Which is half past.
Yes.
If you watch it.
So, Daryl, what's going to happen this week? Anything exciting on your pipeline in the upcoming weeks? It is a fix, hack, and learn in Microsoft week, so nothing is really happening. Are you doing
something? Oh, no. This is the week that everything exciting happens. Yes. I'm actually hacking around on building tooling to help our API review process. So that we can better visualize when teams come to us with API reviews, we can understand how it impacts the larger Graph API and be able to provide quicker and more accurate guidance to the team. So that's what I'm playing around with this week.
Cool.
What about you, Waldeck?
I am new to the team, so it's like I apparently missed all of the hacking. It's like I heard left and right. Okay, so there's this hack.
Maybe we should have actually explained what the fixed hack learn week is.
It wasn't part of INEO, so I don't know.
So the fixed hack learn week is basically one week in a year or two? It's just two times in a year, isn't it? I think it's two times in a year.
It's at least two times. Yeah. But he's on the other side of he's on the Azure side. His fixed hack learn might be a different week.
Oh, so for us, every week it's a
but basic idea in the is it experiences and devices, E&D side of the house, is that one or a few times in a year, we have a 1 week where you can actually do hacking and hacking and projects. So you're not expected to actually work on your day-to-day job. So you can actually come up with a hobby project and build that and then show it off on the end of the week or next week. And there are actually really huge products in Microsoft portfolio which have come and started from somebody actually doing a fixed hack learn week. And then people are like, well, this is awesome. We're going to make this huge. So cool. I think it's an awesome opportunity for everybody in Microsoft to actually really innovate and do something crazy. So
as long as you are in the E&D org, right?
You get your turn. It just comes on a different
week. I'm getting it every day, seriously.
Well, yeah, as a cloud advocate, so it's a different role for sure.
Yes,
so
it is.
Anything interesting on your side, Valdek, this week?
I'm hoping that we will be able to publish a new quick start for the Microsoft Graph Toolkit and React. So I'm trying to explain better how it works, how you can use that in React apps. Yeah. Other than that, I've just submitted a PR to update the SharePoint Starter Kit, one of the web parts, to use MGT React. Other than that, there are a few things still in flux, so no announcement there yet, but things will be coming out, hacking away.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff which we're being built on. By end of this year, we need to get stuff ready, and so that the second half we can restart from a clean slate, so to say. So, but there's a lot of cool stuff happening as well. I'm not going to actually, I can't talk about what I'm doing this week.
Because right. I'm not doing anything, so I cannot talk about it.
yes. Anyway, thank you, Daryl, for joining us for the quick check. I think it's your team's role, and what's your role, and why are you jumping always on people on the Twitter and saying, no, just kidding.
Well, and also that, I mean, on the outside, for a big part, people think Graph, I mean, it's just an API, and there's so much more to it. It meets the eye. So I guess it's really awesome for you to come on the show and explain it to our visitors, viewers, readers, listeners.
And then, you mentioned the Magical Graph Toolkit, which is then a reusable web components built on top of the Microsoft Graph. So it's growing.
Graph in your web app.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you inviting me on, and I had a blast.
Cool.
Thank you.
That was the objective. So thank you, Daryl. Thank you for people who are listening. Thank you, people who are watching. And we'll come up with a new PMP Weekly within a week. So bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.